Chapter 8. The sea increased during the night, so that by dawn the reef surrounding the little island was whiter still, with broken water flying high, particularly on the windward side, and the solemn, measured boom of rollers filled the air. Jack was conscious of this before he opened his eyes. He was also pretty sure that the breeze had strengthened too, backing perhaps as much as a whole point, and this was confirmed when he walked quietly from their shelter under the palm trees, leaving Stephen curled in sleep, and sat on the white strand, yawning and stretching himself. The scene before him was one of extraordinary beauty. The sun was not yet high enough to make the coral sand blaze and glare, but it did bring out the bright green of the lagoon in all its glory, the whiteness of the breakers, the ocean blue beyond them, and the various purities of the sky, ranging by imperceptible gradations from violet in the extreme west to something wholly celestial where the sun was rising. He was aware of it, and together with the lively freshness of the day, it delighted all that part of his mind which was not taken up with trying to estimate the course of the Pahi while they were aboard her, and their present position with regard to the Surprise's probable line of return. He'd made attempts before this, of course, and many of them, but at that time his wits were too harassed to supply him with any convincing answer. He'd merely assured Stephen that all was well, capital, quite in order, and had gone to sleep. Far down into sleep, with waves of figures rising and falling in his head. So many things had happened yesterday that he hadn't paid as much attention as he should have done to the Pahi's speed or direction. But he did remember that she kept the wind between 2 and 3 points abaft the beam, apart from the last leg. And as for her speed, he doubted whether it would have exceeded 4 knots at any time. An uncommon, genius, well-contrived craft, he reflected, but necessarily frail, and happier on a wind than sailing large. I shouldn't be surprised if she lay to during the night when the sea began to get up. I shouldn't be surprised if she were still lying a try at present, some few hours to leeward. 4 miles in each hour, then, and the course allowing for leeway in the last leg to northward, probably within 0.5 of west-northwest. He drew 2 lines in the sand, the one marking the Pahi's voyage from where she took them aboard to the island, the other the Surprise's westward continuation and her return close-hauled. She should now be sailing westward once again, having lain to during the darkness at some point to the east of where they'd been lost, and at present she should be somewhere near the right meridian. He dropped a perpendicular from the island to this second line and looked very grave. He checked his figures and looked graver still. Even with all her boats spread to the utmost limit, it was scarcely possible that she should see this low island so far to the north. A speck of land in such an immensity of sea, a speck shown on no chart so that no one would expect it. "Scarcely possible," he said. But then, with a sudden jet of hope, he remembered that the Pahi's sheets had been slackened off during church, almost to the point of flapping. That shortened his perpendicular, not by a great deal. Perhaps 1.5 miles, or even 2 miles for every hour of dancing and harangue, but enough to loosen the cold grip round his heart a little. The question was, how long would Mowat persist in his search, with all the boats strung out and the frigate moving slowly? perhaps steering a zigzag course to cover more of the ocean. Jack was known to be a very good swimmer, but no man could stay afloat indefinitely. With a proper regard for the frigate's duty, for her pursuit of the Norfolk, how long could Mowat go on combing the apparently empty sea? Had he already abandoned it? There were Hogg's words about unmarked islands, but even so. "Good morning to you, Jack," said Stephen. "Is it not the elegant day? How I hope you slept as well as I did. A most profound, restoring plunge into comfortable darkness. Have you seen the ship yet?" "No, not yet. Tell me, Stephen, how long do you think their ceremonies lasted yesterday? Their church, as you might say." "Oh, no great time at all, I'm sure." "But surely, Stephen, the sermon went on for hours." "'Twas boredom and dread that made it seem so long." "Nonsense," said Jack. "Why, brother," said Stephen, "you look quite furious. You dash out your drawing in the sand. Are you vexed at not seeing the ship?" "It will soon appear, I'm sure. Your explanation last night convinced me entirely. Nothing could have been more reasonable nor more cogently expressed." He scratched himself for a short while. "You've not yet swum, I find. Might it not set you up and rectify the humours?" "It might," said Jack, smiling. "But truly, I've had enough of swimming for a while. I'm still sodden through and through like a soused pig's face." "Then, in that case," says Stephen, "I trust you'll not think it improper if I suggest that you climb up a coconut tree for our breakfast. I've made repeated and earnest attempts, but I have never ascended higher than 6 feet, or perhaps 7, before falling, often with painful and perhaps dangerous abrasions. There are some parts of the mariner's art in which I am still a little deficient, whereas you are the complete sailor man." Complete he was. But Jack Aubrey hadn't climbed a coconut tree since he was a slim, nimble reefer in the West Indies. He was still tolerably nimble, but he now weighed rather more than 16 stone, and he looked thoughtfully at the towering palms. The thickest stem was not much above 18 inches across, yet it shot up 100 feet. There wasn't one that stood straight even in a dead calm, and now that a fine topsail breeze was blowing, they swayed far over in a most graceful and elastic fashion. It was not the swaying that made Jack pensive. Wild, irregular motion was, after all, reasonably familiar to him, but rather the thought of what 16 stone might do at the top end of such a lever, its motion unconstrained by shrouds, forestays or backstays, and the immense force that it would exert upon the lower part of the trunk, and upon roots sunk in little more than coral sand and a trifle of vegetable debris. He padded about the sparse grove, looking for the stoutest of them all. "At least," he observed, gazing up at the outburst of green high above, "at least the spreading top will break the fall if it does come down." And there were times during his long and arduous upward journey when it seemed that the pole must come down, must yield under the great and increasing mechanical advantage of his body heaving upon it, sometimes at an angle of 45 degrees when the wind brought the tree far over. But no, after every plunge the palm swept up again, so fast and so far beyond the vertical that he had to cling tight. And eventually there he was among the great fronds, firmly wedged and breathing easy after his climb, he and the palm top speeding to and fro on the now familiar trajectory, a kind of inverted swing, quite exhilarating in a way, even for one who was intensely anxious, hungry and thirsty. And as the palm came upright on its 10th backward heave, far out there to leeward, he saw the Pahi lying to. "Stephen," he called.
"Hello."
"I see the Pahi. Perhaps 12 miles to leeward lying too."
"Is that so? Listen, Jack, are you privately eating a nut up there and drinking, while I perish here for mere want? The shame of it!"
The palm bowed to a gust and rose again, slower and slower, to its height, and Jack, now perched higher still among the fronds, let out a great bellowing roar.
"There she lays! There she lays! There she lays!"
For clear on the horizon, further than the double canoe and well to the south, he saw the Surprise's topsails in her lower yards. She had her starboard tacks aboard, and she was steering for the Pahi with the wind almost on her beam. He explained this to Stephen at some length as the palm swayed to and fro.
"Is there anything you must do at this point?"
asked Stephen in a moderate shout above the thunder of the sea, the sound of the wind, and the high clatter of the palms themselves.
"Why, no,"
said Jack in the same strong voice. "She must be 7 or 8 leagues away. There's nothing I can do for quite a while until she can see a signal."
"Then I do beg you'll cease springing about in that reckless, inconsiderate way. Throw down some coconuts now, will you? And let's have our breakfast, at least, for our love."
"Stand from under, then," said Jack, sending down a deadly rain of nuts. And setting foot on the ground some minutes later,
"No huzzay, no capers."
"Why should I cry huzzay or cut capers?"
"Because of the ship, of course."
"But you always said it would be there."
"Why didn't you choose green coconuts? These are as hard as cannonballs, old hairy things. Can't you tell one from another, good from bad? God and Mary preserve you, but will I open you one? To be drinking?"
"Pray do. I'm fairly clemmed with climbing and hallooing."
"Stephen, you have a knife."
"Not at all. It's my pocket lancet. I'd taken it to deal with a damnable knot in my shoestring. The valuable shoes you made me kick off. And I'd forgot it until last night when it dug into my side as I lay. This I regret. Had I remembered, we could have made some slight acknowledgement of that dear broad-shouldered young woman's kindness. I think of her with great affection."
Jack heartily agreed, saying all that was proper with great warmth, and adding, "But, however, he does open an old coconut finally, and it'll be most uncommon useful for boring holes when I set about rigging up some kind of signal later on."
This signal took him all the morning and rather more. It was a tripod made from the long ribs of palm fronds lashed together with yarn worked from the leaves and passed through lancet holes. The hole made fast to the topmost growth of the tallest tree and flying Captain Aubrey's shirt. It stood on its elastic base quite well, making a strange, sharp, conspicuous, angular shape among all those billowing curves. But by the time it was finished, and he had made the last of his countless journeys down that lofty stem, his heart was very low. He had, in fact, little or no faith in his tripod or his shirt. Throughout the morning, at intervals between spells of fine work, he'd observed that the sky was spoiling from the east, the wind strengthening and backing still more, and the great swell increasing. But much more than that, he'd watched the movements of the frigate and the Pahi with passionate intensity. To his astonishment, he'd seen the Pahi strike a deckhouse and put before the wind goose-winged, with a square mat sail set between the masts, a rig he didn't know she was capable of, and one that carried her away westwards at a spanking pace. The Surprise had borne up to intercept her, and so both ran fast and far on converging courses a great way to the leeward of the island. They were now at such a distance that under the clouded sky he could only now and then catch the flash of the frigate's sails on the rise, while the Pahi had practically vanished. He couldn't tell whether the frigate had spoken the Pahi or not. All he knew was that both wind and sea had strengthened, and that even if by some extraordinarily lucky chance the surprise gained any information from the Pahi, it must be fragmentary, uncertain, totally unreliable. With this wind, this head sea, and this current, a square-rigged ship might beat up for the island a week on end and gain no eastward distance at all. A waste of time that couldn't be justified by the vague pointing of a crew of monoglot and largely hostile women, even supposing they pointed at all. Duty would require Moet to carry on to the Marquesas.
"Never look so careworn, brother," said Stephen. "Sit comfortably on the ground and listen to the noble booming of the sea, how it thunders."
"Aye, so it does," said Jack. "It's certainly been blowing very hard somewhere to raise this almighty swell. But I tell you what, Stephen, I'm afraid the weather must be breaking up in these parts too. And even if it don't, perhaps we should make up our minds to staying on this island for quite a considerable time. Capital fishing, I dare say, and winkles for relish once we can get onto the reef." Stephen objected that the ship was just at hand. Jack replied that she had run far to the lee. Stephen said that in that case she must ply diligently to windward. And once again Jack was about to explain the increasing degree of leeway that even the most weatherly ship must make as the increasing force of the wind obliged the sails to be reefed or taken in, when he reflected that his explanation would do no good. Invincible ignorance could not be enlightened. And although no doubt he might succeed in making Stephen anxious and unhappy, this wouldn't really advance them very much. He therefore listened quietly to his friend's assurance that Mowat would certainly find some means of overcoming these difficulties. Impossible was not a word he connected with the Navy. Nothing could exceed the zeal of the mariners. And should there be a little delay, it would enable him to complete his study of the island's flora and fauna. Only a brief delay was required, however, so pitifully meagre was the tale by land. "But," said Stephen after these comfortable words, "I've been contemplating on coral, and my mind is staggered, amazed, confounded at the thought of these countless myriads of animalcula industriously sifting the lime from the seawater for so vast a sequence of generations, and in such prodigious quantities that they form this island, this reef, to say nothing of the countless others that do exist. And all founded upon what? Upon the skeletons of other coral polyps. The calcareous external skeletons of other coral polyps in quantities that run far beyond conception. That's what. For I do assure you, Jack, that everything here, apart from these trifling adventitious vegetables," waving towards the palms, "is coral. Living or dead, coral sand or solid coralline accumulation. There is no subjacent rock at all. How can it have begun in this deep tempestuous sea? The force of these waves is very great. The animalculum's miserably frail. How do these islands come about? I cannot tell at all. I cannot form the beginning of a hypothesis." "No underlying rock, you say?" "None whatsoever, brother. Coral, all coral and nothing but coral." He paused, shaking his head, and sank deep into thought while Jack looked out over the green lagoon to the leaping wall of white water on the far side of the reef, reflecting that presently he should try to find something in the way of bait, and then wade out with Manu's line on the end of a palm rib. He'd gone on to think about ways of making fire when Stephen said, "And these things being so, I become convinced that the large, rounded object about the size of a mother turtle, but more lumpish there on the strand to your right, where the water is lapping, it couldn't be a boulder. No, I have more than half persuaded myself that it is an enormous piece of ambergris washed up by the sea." "Haven't you been to look at it?" "I have not." The association of rarity, wealth, and so on instantly brought that unfortunate brass box to my mind. That most unwelcome box from the Danae packet which is now aboard the Surprise. And as the recollection came to me, so I grew perfectly convinced, as by your revelation, that rats or cockroaches or bookworms or various moulds were eating its contents to our utter ruin, eating them with tropical avidity, a million of money. The thought fairly cut my legs from under me, and I've sat here ever since. That's 1,000 to 1 we shall never have any need of the brass box, nor of the ambergris, unless it can be eaten, said Jack to himself. And if the weather goes on breaking up like this, if it really comes on to blow, and Surprise is driven a great way to leeward, then it's 10,000 to 1 or more. Much more. But aloud, giving Stephen a hand up, he said, let's go and have a look. If it is ambergris, we're made men. We have but to go to the nearest dealer and change it for its weight in gold. It was not ambergris. It was a piece of crystalline limestone, mottled and in part translucent. And it fairly stupefied Maturin. How can such things be? He asked, gazing out into the offing. There's no question of glaciers, icebergs. How can such things possibly come about?
There's the boat.
I have it, he cried. This rock was brought tangled in the roots of a tree, a great tree swept away by some remote flood or tornado, cast up after the dear knows how many thousand miles of drifting, and here decaying, leaving its incorruptible burden. Come, Jack, help me turn it. See, he cried with a shining face as it heaved over. In these unfractuosities there are still traces of my roots. What a discovery!
What did you mean when you said boat?
Why, our boat, of course, the big one, the launch, come to fetch us, as you always said it would. Lord Jack! He said, looking up with an entirely different expression. How in God's name shall I ever face them at all? He was still there, sitting by his rock, when the Surprise's launch, following her captain's directions from the height of his palm tree, dashed through the perilous gap in the reef, crossed the lagoon, and ran nose up onto the shore. Oh, sir, cried Honey, leaping from the bows and very nearly clasping his captain in his arms, how glad I am to see you. We caught sight of the signal a couple of hours ago, but scarcely dared hope it was you. How are you, sir? And the doctor? This last with a very anxious, doubtful cock of his head. He's prime, I thank you, Honey, and so am I, said Jack, shaking his hand. And then, louder, to the crew of the boat, who were staring round on their thwarts, nodding, becking, and grinning, against all decent naval order. Well, fare ye, shipmates, you're most heartily welcome. A long pull? About 8 hours, sir, said Bondon, laughing as though this were a really brilliant witticism. Then haul her up a couple of foot and come ashore. I dare say we shall have to push off with the turn of the tide, but you'll have time to wet your whistles with a coconut or two. Mr. Calamy, you'll find the doctor sitting by a rock on the other side of the island at low water mark. Tell him, is there anything to eat or drink in the boat? Which Killick put up some milk punch and pickled seal, sir, in case you wasn't dead, said Bondon. And we have our rations. Tell him punch and seal, then. Tell him we're going to have a sup and a bite if he chooses to join us. But in any case, he should hold himself in readiness to leave quite soon, as I fear it may come on to blow. Now, Mr. Honey, pray let me know what happened.
They'd been missed a little before dawn, when a swabber of the afterguard saw the stern windows wide open. On being told, Mowat instantly cried, "It's the doctor!" and put the ship about. All the officers worked out a course that should take the ship back to the point where the captain was last known to be aboard. This course they followed for several hours, seeing driftwood 4 times,
until they reached the position they determined upon, which they did with an excellent observation to check it, but with their hearts in their boots, and their eyes fairly destroyed with having stared so long quite in vain. They then lay to for the night, taking very great care to fore-reach a trifle to counteract the current. All the officers were on deck or in the tops, and the atmosphere was like that of an undertaker's barge with a crew of mutes. Before dawn they spread the boats out as before, and at first light they began their westward sweep. Almost at once they were cheered by the sight of two more tree trunks, battered but not waterlogged, floating quite high, which renewed their hope. And shortly after this the northernmost boat, one of the cutters, the Blue Cutter, Seven Bells in the Morning Watch, beg pardon, Your Honour, said Bondon, signalled something very likely, and they bore up. It proved to be only an empty barrel, but it was a United States Navy beef barrel, and quite fresh. A beef barrel, eh? Said Jack with intense satisfaction. Carry on, Mr. Honey. Then, at the changing of the watch, Hogg, the whaler's specksioneer, came aft and said there was an island away to the north. Asked how he knew, pointed out a patch of white cloud and a green reflection in the sky. He was supported by the other South Sea whalers, who said the island is always navigated by such signs. Asked how far, he said it depended on the size. About 20 miles for a small one, much more for a large. There were plenty of islands not laid down on charts. If the castaways had found a piece of driftwood, could they have reached it? What was the true set of the current? Might it have carried them so far north? Those were the questions that tormented the quarter-deck. Would it be right to leave their known course? It was decided that the distance was too great to warrant a change unless the island's existence were quite certain. But the Blue Cutter was ordered away north-north-east for an hour under all possible sail, while the ship and the other boats carried on their sweep. This, on the reasoning that if the island existed, it would cause an indraft attracting driftwood from a great way off. Time went by slowly, but at last the cutter was seen racing back. Her signals were hard to make out, because now that the surprise had moved farther westward, she could only see the flags end on. And what was more, cloud was coming up, spoiling the light. It was not until the boat was almost within hailing distance that they understood she had seen not only a low island, but also a two-masted vessel far to the west-nor-west of it. By this time the wind was freshening and backing east, or even north of east. The sea was getting up, and greasy weather was surely on the way. Hogg and the other whalers said they'd known a very heavy blow indeed in these waters after just such a swell. This was probably their last chance, they thought, so they called the boats in and altered course, feeling almighty queer. They cracked on, and presently the lookout on the jacks caught sight of the sail. "That was me, sir," cried Calamy, "with old Boyle's spyglass." Hogg went aloft and declared the sail to be a native craft, a double canoe, very like a Tuamotu Pahi, though not quite the same in some particulars. And while he was considering it, he also saw the island, farther off and to the east. Mowat at once manned and provisioned the launch, and told Honey to proceed to the island with all possible dispatch. For his part, he was going to see whether the Pahi had picked them up, or whether its people could give any information. Hogg understood the language of the islands, and then to lie to until the launch should rejoin. He fixed a rendezvous in the Marquesas in case of dirty weather. The launch was rigged as a schooner, and she was a fine, weatherly boat, but it had been clear from the start that beating up would never do, and they'd taken to their oars, thus becoming practically invisible from the island in such a sea. After a few hours, the people had grown quite tired and jaded, pulling against what was now a head sea or close on. But then, standing up with his glass,
Honey had seen Jack's shirt flying from the palm tree, and after that they'd stretched out like heroes. Both Davis and Padine Coleman, Stephen's servant, had broken their oars.
"Remind me to stop it out of their pay, Mr. Honey," said Jack.
And when the mirth had died away, for this was perhaps his most deeply relished stroke of wit since Gibraltar, "at least Sawhands will have a rest once we're out of the lagoon. I saw the barkey right to leeward, and with this breeze we should rejoin before sunset, never touching an oar. Bondon, cut along to the doctor." For Stephen had sent back a message by Calamy to the effect that he wasn't hungry. "Had some last investigations to make, would come presently. And tell him we're off, and help him into the stern sheets while the master's stepping. It would be as well," raising his voice, "for nobody to wish him joy or ask him how he does. He's been taken a little poorly, what with soaking so long and drinking salt water." Jack needn't have spoken. At least, not to the seamen. In their delicacy, they would never have taken the least notice of Stephen's misfortune, nor have made him feel the enormous amount of trouble he'd caused. And in fact, when he came sidling awkwardly down the strand, they showed what might have been taken for a brutal indifference, relieved only by the singular gentleness with which he was lifted in and settled with a sailcloth apron over his knees and somebody's old blue jacket about his shoulders. In the course of their flying voyage westwards, with the launch impelled by following seas and an ever more powerful wind, Stephen's spirits recovered a little, particularly when Jack gave an account of their time aboard the Pahi. He couldn't have had a more attentive or more appreciative audience. How they laughed at his near castration, and the doctor's terror when his pig misbehaved and the boatswain's mates stood behind him. And after a while, Stephen added a few details, feeling much more at his ease. Yet when the ship came in sight, when she came so close that people could be seen against the low sunset sky, running about the deck and waving their hats, he lapsed into silence again. But the hearty, unfeigned, affectionate welcome and the underlying kindness so characteristic of the service, brutal though it was at times, would have dealt with a temperament far more morose than Stephen's. In any case, his professional skill was called upon at once. The boarding party sent to the Pahi had been repelled with shocking ferocity. Martin and Hogg, leading the way with presents and kind words, had almost instantly been clubbed, and the seamen who dragged them back to the boat speared, beaten with heavy wooden blades, and stabbed with bamboo skewers, all in a terrible yelling, screaming uproar. Five men were in the sick bay with wounds far beyond the Loblolly boys' competence, all inflicted within a few moments of the attempted boarding, while the hail of slingstones and darts delivered as the Pahi sheered off accounted for another half dozen less serious casualties. "They didn't give a damn for gunfire," said Mowat in the cabin. "I don't believe they knew what it was. Every time we sent a shot near or over their heads, they jumped up and down and waved their spears. I could have knocked away a spar or two, of course, but in such a sea. And in any case, we could see he wasn't aboard. And as for information, they would never have given us any, I'm sure." "You did very well, Mowat," said Jack. "In your place, I should have been terrified they might attack the ship." "I have the villain," said Stephen in the sick bay, where he was operating by the last of the daylight and 17 purser's dips. "I have him in my crow's bill. A shark's tooth, as I'd supposed, detached from the club and driven into the gluteus maximus to a most surprising depth. The question is, what shark?" "May I see it?" asked Martin in a reasonably firm voice. He'd already had 36 stitches in his scalp, while a square foot of court plaster covered his lacerated shoulders. But he was a man of some fortitude, and above all a natural philosopher. "A shark, without a doubt," he said.
holding the tooth down towards the deck, for he was lying on his belly. Most of the surprises had been wounded ingloriously from behind, running away as fast as ever they could. But what shark, I can't tell. However, I shall keep it in my snuff-box and look at it whenever I think about matrimony. Whenever I think about women, indeed. Dear me, I shall never pull off my hat to one again without remembering today. Do you know, Maturin, as I set foot on that floating thing, that pie, I saluted the woman confronting me, bowing and baring my head, and she instantly took advantage of it to strike me down.
"This is the far side of the world," said Stephen.
"Now your calf, if you please. I'm afraid we shall have to cut it bodily out. I'd hoped to push it through, but the tibia's in the way. Perhaps we could wait until tomorrow," said Martin, whose fortitude had its limits.
"A barbed spearhead cannot wait," said Stephen. "I wish to see no proud flesh, no black mortification, no gangrene spreading upwards. Pratt, I believe Mr. Martin would like to be attached. Otherwise he might give an involuntary start, and there I should be in an artery."
With quick, practised fingers he passed a leather-covered chain round Martin's ankle and another behind his knee. Pratt made them fast to ring-bolts, effectually pinning the limb and its owner. These were motions Stephen had made again and again, and they were as familiar to him as his patient's unwillingness to be operated upon and all their transparent shifts. He was very much at home in this place, with his familiar instruments, the smell of tallow, bilgewater, tow, lint, the rum and tincture of laudanum with which he deadened those whom he would be obliged to cut deep. And when he'd finished bandaging the leg, Martin was silent now, having drifted away on his drug at last. He felt quite part of the ship once more. He stood up, threw his operating coat into its usual corner, washed his hands, and walked into the cabin. Jack was writing in a book. He glanced up, said, "There you are, Stephen," with a smile, and wrote on, his pen scratching busily. Stephen sat down in his particular chair and looked about the beautiful room. Everything was in its place. Jack's telescopes in their rack, his sword hanging by the barometer, the cello and fiddle cases lying where they always lay, and the particularly magnificent gold-mounted dressing case come music stand, Diana's present to her husband, standing where it always stood. And the unlucky brass box from the Danaer, its seals intact, was hidden behind the foot railing, as he knew very well. But there was something amiss. And all at once he noticed that deadlights had been fitted to the stern windows. No one could possibly fall out of them. "No, it's not that," said Jack, catching his look. "That had been locking the horse out of the stable door is gone, a very foolish thing to do. Still and all, there are some horses that are obliged to be controlled, I fear. No, it was just that I think we may have a blow, and I don't choose to lose the window glasses again." "Is that right? I'd supposed the sea was calmer." "So it is. But the barometer has dropped in a very horrid manner. Forgive me, Stephen, I must just finish this page." The ship rose and fell, rose and fell. A pure, long, following sea, with never a hint of roll in it. Jack's pen squeaked on. At some distance, Killick's disagreeable voice could be heard singing, "Heave and ho, rum below!" And presently the smell of toasted cheese reached the cabin. This was their particular delight in the evening. But there'd been no cheese, toasted or otherwise, in the great cabin for some thousands of miles. Could there be such things as olfactory illusions? Wondered Stephen, blinking at the lantern as it swung fore and aft, fore and aft. Conceivably. There was, after all, no limit at all to error. But then again, he reflected, Killick's notion of his perquisites had a right naval breadth to it. He stole as steadily and conscientiously as the boatswain. But whereas the boatswain by immemorial custom might sell his winnings without being thought the worse of so long as he wasn't caught, not unless he criminally weakened the ship, the same did not apply to the captain's steward. And Killick never passed anything over the side. His perquisites were for himself and his friends. And it was possible that he'd preserved a piece of the almost imperishable Manchego or Parmesan for some private feast of his own. Physical, material, objective cheese was certainly toasting no very great way off. Stephen was aware that his mouth was watering, but that at the same time his eyes were closing. A curious combination, truly. He heard Jack say that it was certainly going to blow, and with that he went fast to sleep.